This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents All In by Emma Scott. Narrated by Jeremy York and Caitlin Kelly. Full tilt, noun, 1. With maximum energy or force, at top speed. Part 1. Prologue. Theo. Theo, dear, he wants you. Casey's soft hand tightened in mine. I looked at my brother's girlfriend, who gave a wan, reassuring smile. Another squeeze of her hand, then I somehow found the will to stand up. My mother smiled weakly, hanging on Dad's arm in the hall outside Jonah's hospital room. She looked so lost and broken. Frail. Dad looked grim but stoic, holding Mom up. But Jonah was the glue in our family. Without him, we were going to fall apart. It was only a matter of time. It was time now to say goodbye to my brother. As I walked toward the door of his room, a carousel of images circled my head, each faded with time, as if they'd sat out in the bright sun too long. Jonah and me feeding a goat at the state fair. Jonah and me in swim lessons together, in our little league uniforms, walking high school hallways where Jonah was effortlessly popular. And I was his wingman, visiting Jonah at UNLV, then at Carnegie Mellon, swimming with Jonah in Venezuela, where he got sick, and I didn't. I pushed the door shut and moved to where Jonah lay dying, a thin, pale version of the healthy guy in my mind's photo album.
Theo!
My brother, struggling to breathe, struggling to hold on, while I was still strong, strong and ready to tear down the walls of this goddamn place, to set the whole fucking world on fire at the unfairness of it all. Still not strong enough to walk over to his bed and say goodbye. Jonah managed a weak smile.
That bad, huh?
You've looked worse, I said, finally moving into the room and taking a seat beside his bed.
Bite me.
His chuckle was a horrible-sounding wheeze. His hand twitched on the blankets. He didn't even have the strength to lift it. I reached to clasp it, wrapping my fingers around his. Jonah's smile faded, and his eyes, still sharp, met mine.
I'm worried about Mom.
His heart could only pump enough air for two or three words at a time, squeezing them out between shallow intakes of breath. I'll take care of her, I said.
And Dad, he'll come around about your shop. I believe in you.
I doubted our father would ever support my work as a tattoo artist. But at that moment, Jonah's I believe in you was all I needed.
Now,
Jonah said, his gaze intent.
The favor I want from you. Remember?
I sat forward in the chair. Name it.
Casey.
My voice stuck in my throat. I coughed it free. What about her?
You love her.
The words were weak and soft, yet each one struck my chest like a hammer. I couldn't speak, couldn't move, could hardly blink. I was on fire, a million different emotions boiling in my guts, stealing my air, choking my words. Despite keeping everything buried, deep down, where it could never see the light of day and betray my brother, he saw everything. He always had. He smiled at my paralyzed expression.
I'm glad, T. I'm so relieved it's you.
I almost found my voice to tell him it wasn't me. I wasn't anything. What the hell did I know about love? Not a damn thing. And he was wrong anyway. She'll never love me because she loves only you, which is how it should be.
The favor.
Jonah's gaze bored into mine with all the strength his failing body lacked.
Take care of Casey. Please. She'll need you. She's strong. But if she falls, help her. Love her, Theo. This life is short. Don't hold back. Okay?
I nodded. Only because he needed me to. Not because I had any fucking clue how to do what he was asking of me. Jonah eased a sigh of relief. He was beyond exhausted, and had yet to see Casey, to say goodbye to the love of his life. I couldn't waste their time. It was time now. I clenched my jaw hard against the tears, but they came anyway. Say it. It's now or never. You'll never have this chance again. I love you, I said through gritted teeth.
Me too,
Jonah said, his voice so weak and thin.
Love you, T. Always will.
The grief slammed into me, pressed me down. I buried my face in the crook of my arm, battling it back. I had to be strong, for Mom and Dad, and for Casey, for Jonah, who had given me a job to do. I'll get Casey, I said, wiping my eyes. I planted my feet and tried to rise, but could only get halfway out of the chair. Still clasping Jonah's hand, I leaned to put my forehead to his, to hold him close to me one last time. My brother. Jonah sighed my name. I'll take care of her, I said, my voice cracking. I swear. It was half the promise, but the half I could keep. I'm not going to be able to walk out of here. But I did. I left my brother's room and leaned against the wall outside his door, feeling like I was on a ship tossed at sea. That was it. The last time I'll ever see him or talk to him. I'll never talk to my brother again. Never hear his voice, his words. And his last words. Love her. My eyes sought Casey in the waiting area. Something to grab onto. Something real. She'd fallen out of the goddamn sky like a bomb, blowing up our careful life, smashing routines and disrupting Jonah's plans. First, I was scared she'd leave him, and when it was clear she wasn't going to, I was scared her staying would hurt Jonah too much. He'd have to say goodbye after only a handful of weeks together. Casey walked toward Jonah's room, her stride graceful, her face racked by grief, but burning with love at the same time. She filled up my eyes as Jonah's dying wish echoed in my ear. I had one short, selfish, miserable second of hope. Then I squashed it flat. Killed it. Sorry, bro. She's yours. And she'll be yours to the end of time. but I could take care of her. Black days were coming, weeks, months, possibly years. However long she needed me, I'd be there for her. 1 month after the funeral, I got a call from my mother.
Theo, dear, there's no answer at Casey's. I've been calling for 2 days now.
Her voice crackled with panic over the phone. She couldn't take another hit. Neither could I. I called Casey. An automated message said her cell phone was no longer in service. I called the Luxor, where she'd managed to get hired after quitting Caesars. They said she hadn't been in for 3 days. I went to her place and banged on the door. No answer. I banged harder, and her elderly neighbor came out.
"She's gone, young man," the lady said, annoyed. "Didn't you see? Her car's not here."
"When did she leave?" The woman narrowed her eyes at me, sizing me up.
2 nights ago. Like she was sneaking out, stealing her own things. Nervous."
My heart's pulse slowed to a heavy clang of dread. "She took stuff with her?"
"Boxes, suitcases."
The woman ran her hands down her flowered house dress.
"And these strange glass bottles with cords coming out of them. Don't know what on earth."
"Lamps," I said dully. "They were lamps made from old whiskey bottles."
"If you say so."
I rubbed the stubble along my jaw. The tension had seeped out of my body, the grief now seeping back in.
"She left a letter with me," the neighbor said. "Asked that I give it only to Beverly, Teddy, or Henry Fletcher."
The woman peered at me.
"Are you one of those?"
"I'm Theo Fletcher." I cleared my throat. "She calls me Teddy. Calls.
"Hold on."
The woman went into her place and came back out with a piece of paper folded in half. My eyes scanned over the words. "I can't stay here. I tried, but it's too much. I love you all. I'm sorry. Casey." The note fell from my hand like a dead leaf, rocking through the air to land at my feet. The neighbor said something softly and retreated into her apartment. I stood alone on the walkway, staring at Casey's door. "I'm sorry, Jonah," I thought, the words blasting louder and louder with every beat of my heart. "I had one job here, not even half a job, and I'd failed." Chapter 1. Theo. 6 months after the funeral. The alarm blared at 6 a.m. I snaked out my hand and shut it off. For a few seconds, I was good. Everything was all right. Then I remembered Jonah was gone, and the rest of the day sledgehammered into my chest. I sucked in a breath and stared at the ceiling until the first wave passed, then immediately threw off the covers. The best part of my day was those first 3 seconds. Then I had to immediately get up, get ahead of it, keep moving. Otherwise, I'd lie in bed all day like an ass, pissing and moaning over what I couldn't change. Get up, shake it out of the covers, and kick it under the bed. A small voice inside whispered I'd better clean that shit out and fucking deal with it before I exploded. I was dealing. I was getting up, going to work, doing my goddamn best. My gym clothes were waiting at the foot of the bed, where I'd set them the night before. I dressed, hit the kitchen for some water and a protein bar. The morning sun glinted off the glass paperweights on the windowsill. All Jonah's creations, One had a sea life seen inside. The sunlight cutting through the glass made it look alive. It was Casey's favorite. She once told me she thought it looked quiet inside the glass. Peaceful. The watery composition made her feel safe when she woke up the first time on Jonah's couch. I looked inside the sphere and felt suffocated. Trapped. Immobile. Like the sea life. In my truck on the way to the gym, I passed Jonah's old place, then Casey's 3 blocks later. Both empty now, except for Jonah's glass paperweight sitting on my windowsill and a handwritten note. Everything belonging to them was in a storage unit at the north end of town. Idling at a red light, my thoughts returned to her 4 scribbled lines, mulling them over like song lyrics, followed by the chorus. I failed, Jonah. A honk from behind jolted me. The red light was green. I hit the gas, tires screeching, then eased off and forced myself to chill the fuck out before I got in a wreck. At the gym, I lifted and pressed until my arm muscles were screaming and the sweat poured down my face. I did sit-ups until I thought I'd puke, then set a bar over my shoulders and did squats until my legs were shaking. I worked out for 2 solid hours, trying to sweat out the feelings buried in my guts. It left me exhausted and wanting more sleep. I didn't get much these days, but rest wasn't part of my routine. I showered, dressed in jeans and a t-shirt, and went back to my place to cook up some lunch. I sat at my kitchen counter, the small business management textbook open. An enormous fried egg, bacon, and tomato sandwich on my left, my laptop on my right. I had midterms coming up, and the payroll tax stuff was giving me grief. 3 hours of solid study made me feel a little better. About my tests, anyway. I closed up my textbooks and laptop, and hid them away in a dresser in case Oscar and Dina dropped by. They always asked a million fucking questions about me going back to UNLV for an MBA degree, and I didn't want to talk about it. It was stupid anyway. As if a dumb degree could make anything better. My cell phone rang as I started to head out for work at Vegas Inc., my mother's number on the display. Right on time. Hey, Ma.
Hello, darling. I'm sorry to bother you.
You're not bothering me, Ma. You never are.
I just wanted to see how you're doing.
She called every day, rarely with any real purpose or news to impart, usually just to touch base with the only son she had left. When I saw her in person, she literally touched base, her hand floating toward me whenever I was in reach. I couldn't blame her. I did the same to Jonah every day after his CAV diagnosis.
Dear?
I jerked out of my thoughts. Sorry, Ma. What was that?
I was asking if you'd heard from Casey?
Still nothing. I'm sure she's fine, I added, like I would fucking know after I let her slip away.
You had one job here. Half a job.
I wish she'd at least call, Mom said with false lightness. I wonder where she's gone off to.
I rubbed my hand over the dull ache in my chest. I have to get to work, Ma. If I hear anything from Casey, I'll let you know.
All right, dear.
Realizing I was barely giving her 60 seconds of my time, I asked, What are you and Dad up to?
Oh, nothing much, she said.
God, if she didn't always sound like she was perpetually on the verge of tears.
We'd like to have you, Oscar, and Dina over for dinner Sunday.
Sure, sounds good, I said, gritting my teeth. Once a month or so, we rallied together, mostly because we felt we should. Our duty to old memories and better times. It sucked. The dinners were torture, filled with stilted, stiff conversation, and haunted by Casey's laughter and Jonah's voice. No matter how loud we tried to talk over it, their love affair lingered like the light from one of Jonah's glass lamps. Not even Oscar could lighten the mood. His gigantic personality had been tamped down, and Dina's smile was heavy now. My mother still cooked, but often she let pots boil over while she stared into space. She'd lost weight. So had Dad. His eyes followed my mother constantly, but rarely looked at me. He hardly spoke to me either. We'd never been close, but Jonah always bridged our gap. Without him, an abyss lay between me and my father, a distance neither of us made an effort to close. God damn it, Jonah. Come back and fix all this, because I fucking can't. I'll let Oscar and Dina know, I told my mom. My glance flickered to the front door, the car keys jangling in my hand.
How are your studies going?
Fine. Big tests coming up.
I'm so proud of you, Theo. I think it's wonderful what you're doing. In another year, when you have your degree, just think of what doors will open for you.
Thanks, Mom, I said, trying not to sound as irritated as I felt. Mom's pride in me sounded good on the surface, but she wasn't entirely sold on me opening up a tattoo shop either. She was more supportive than Dad by a mile, but I didn't hold any illusions she was eager to see me spend the money Jonah willed me on a place with loud music and colorful characters, where I'd draw flaming skulls and roses all day long.
Oh, Theo, dear, would you mind stopping by the store this afternoon? I'm out of milk and eggs.
I clenched my jaw. I couldn't go after work, or I'd never make it to class on time. I'd have to go now, swing by my parents' house, then go to work. Late. Dad's working again today? I asked tightly.
Yes,
she sighed.
You know how he is lately.
Yeah, I know. I rubbed my hands over my eyes. I'll hit the store before work. Be there in 30.
Thank you, dear. You take such good care of me.
I gotta go, Ma. I'll see you in a few.
Wonderful, dear. And Theo?
Yeah?
If Casey calls, tell her I'm not angry with her. Tell her I'd just like to know she's okay.
Sure, Ma. I hung up and stared at the screen a long time, willing it to ring again, to light up with Casey's number so I could hear her voice. I only wanted what my mother wanted, to know Casey was okay. Vegas Inc. was busy that day. Our small waiting area had two chicks poring over a three-ringed binder of art and another guy leaning against the wall. It was Edgar's day to pick music, so the buzz of tattoo machines was barely audible under pounding death metal music. Vivian, our receptionist, gave me an arch look as I rushed in.
You're late.
Sorry, Viv, I said, checking over her book for the day's appointments. Don't tell Gus.
I never do, but he's heard the complaints, honey.
I shrugged. Nothing I could do about it. My mother, although perfectly capable of doing things on her own, had retreated into herself. Like a kid who'd been burned, she hardly stuck her hand out anymore. And Dad had thrown himself back into work as if he were a first-time city councilman instead of a 30-year incumbent on the verge of retirement. Someone had to take care of my mom. But sometimes, like today, I knew I had too many balls in the air. My arms were getting tired, and sooner or later, I was going to start dropping them. Gus, the owner of Vegas Inc., firing me for being late all the time, would be the first to smash to the floor.
These two are waiting for you.
Vivian nodded her completely shaved head in the direction of the two young women. The expression on her heavily pierced face was knowing.
New clients. Both asked for you. Personal.
I shrugged. Referral.
Mm-hmm.
Viv raked her eyes up and down my black t-shirt and jeans.
Word must have gotten out about your impressive body of work.
I rolled my eyes as I closed the appointment ledger. I was booked straight through to 6 o'clock.
Oh, come on, it was a little funny, Viv said, leaning over the desk, toying with a pen in her ringed fingers.
Tattoos covered every inch of skin up to her neck and creeping up the back of her skull. She gave one of my biceps a squeeze.
And true. Someone's been hitting the gym harder than usual. I'm not the only one who's noticed.
Viv rubbed her chin on her shoulder, putting her gaze in line with one of the shop's other artists, Zelda Rossi. The small woman was bent over a client, tattoo gun in hand. Long black hair fell like a curtain to shield her face. She raised her head as she wiped the blood welling up from her client's shoulder blade. Her large green eyes, rimmed in black, met mine. A smile started to break over her face. She caught it under her teeth, stuck her tongue out, and went back to work. Viv smirked.
Must be so tough to have so many women throwing themselves at you.
Can't complain, I said with a smug grin. Give me a minute, then send my first appointment in.
Sure thing, baby doll.
Vegas ink was a small, cramped hole in the wall. The bright red paint and black and white checkered floor only made it feel smaller. My place would be different. Darker colors, older furniture, and art on the walls from funky fringe artists like Edward Gorey and Ann Harper. A living room in a haunted house. My place. Jonah gave me the money to open a shop, and I was taking business classes to make sure I didn't fuck it up. Even so, the thought of actually pulling the trigger and buying a place made me sick to my stomach. If I failed, I'd have nothing left of Jonah. He sold his glass so I could have my dream, but what if it went under? What if no one showed up? I'd already lost Casey. One broken promise. I couldn't take another fucking failure. Edgar, a huge hulking guy with a Tool concert shirt stretched over his bulk, looked up from his client and gave me a nod.
Hey, T, what's shaking, man?
Same old, I said, preparing my gun and rags from the second drawer in the armoire. When my first client told me what she wanted, I'd set up the ink and choose the needles.
You want to hang tonight? Me and some friends are going to see Kilroy at the Pony Club.
I flinched, covered it up with a cough.
Nah, I'm busy.
Hot date? Edgar wagged his brow at me, as his client used a hand mirror to inspect the new dragon curling around his calf. Yep, I said. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Zelda glance my way, then bend over her work again. Edgar chuckled.
Don't tell me. It's the redhead you had in here last week. Rose and Dagger, right ankle?
Maybe.
Edgar let out a whoop. You're a whore, Fletcher. Don't ever change.
The two women from the waiting area approached my station. The blonde took a seat in the chair, her friend beside her to hold her hand. They were both hot. Both flirted with me as if their lives depended on it. I did my best to reciprocate, because Edgar was watching. 20 minutes later, the blonde got up from my chair with, "Stay true to yourself," delicately scrawled across the inside of her wrist. She and her friend invited me to a party.
"Yeah, maybe I'll stop by," I said, and waited with mounting irritation as they giggled and insisted I get out my phone to take down their number and address.
I pretended to punch the girl's number into a new contact with my thumb then slipped my phone back into the back pocket of my jeans.
Hope you can make it,
the blonde tossed over her shoulder as the two left. When they were gone, Edgar laughed and shook his head.
I thought you had a date tonight?
I shrugged. I'll take her with me to the party. He laughed a great bellowing laugh.
You're my hero, T.
No, I'm a lying asshole. Ages ago, I would have dialed that phone number the minute I got out of work, and probably gotten little sleep that night. Now, a smoking hot blonde and her friend were no more interesting than a weather report. But letting everyone think I went out with a different woman every night was better than the truth, that since I heard Casey sing around a campfire all those months ago, I was a lost cause. I finished out the day, and as we cleaned up our workspaces, Edgar jerked his chin at me.
Enjoy your date with the redhead, he said. Or the blonde. Or the redhead and the blonde. I want a full report tomorrow.
You'll get it, I said, shrugging into my leather jacket. If they don't wear me out. Edgar laughed, and Zelda flinched. I smiled at her with a small shake of my head, trying to signal this was all bullshit. I'd heard she had a crush on me since she started working here a year ago. It didn't suck to look at her, but I didn't date co-workers. Too messy if things go sour. And with me and women, they always did. Have a good night, Z, I said.
You too, T, she replied.
She looked up then, flashed me a dry smile. Slut. Edgar and I laughed, and the second my back was turned, the smile started teetering on the edge of my face. When I stepped outside the tattoo shop, it dropped like a mask and shattered on the sidewalk. At the Lee Business School at UNLV, I listened to the professor go on about payroll tax and employer ID numbers. I wasn't lost. I got it. The data made sense to me, and I almost felt sort of proud. Like I was getting something done.
I'll remind you again, Professor Haddon said from behind her lectern. This midterm exam is worth 45% of your final grade. You cannot and will not pass this class if you miss it or fail it. Arrange to consult with me if you feel either of those scenarios is a possibility.
My pace to the parking lot was a small victory lap. I wasn't going to miss or fail. No chance. My phone chimed with a text from Oscar. Want to meet up tonight? I don't miss you, but Dina does. I chuckled at the backhanded offer. It had been a long time since I'd hung out with my friends. They were Jonah's friends, first and foremost, his best friends, and hanging out with them had the same quality as having dinner at my parents' place. Ghosts of other times hovered everywhere, like shadows in the periphery. I tapped back. Can't. Have a date.
Should have guessed, Oscar replied. Try for next week?
Sure. How easy it had become to lie. Lie to my co-workers, lie to my friends. It hardly bothered me anymore. We'd all drifted apart after Jonah. He was the center of our goddamn universe, and without him, we were all starting to lose whatever pull it was that kept us in the same orbit. Oscar and Dina tried. My mom tried. But I couldn't muster the energy to smile and laugh and bullshit my way through small talk. It took too much effort to keep the grief in check. Grief of losing Jonah, then Casey. I drove my truck out of the university parking lot, down side streets running parallel to the strip, taking back roads to the Wynn Hotel and Casino. I parked and knocked on the service entrance door. All the security guards knew me. Wilson was on duty tonight.
Evening, Theo,
he said, waving me in. Hey, Wilson. I traverse the back passages and innards of the hotel, down a corridor of cement and bright fluorescent light. Eyes in the sky watched me, but their gaze was benevolent. Nobody would question me. Emi Takamura, the gallery curator, had seen to that. Three right turns, one left, and I pushed open a heavy door, emerging near the elevators on the first floor. I slipped down the hallway across from the clanging casino that never closed. Pauly was standing guard over the locked doors of the Galleria. He'd shooed away the last visitors hours ago.
"How's it going, T?"
he asked, punching in a key code. The red light flashed to green.
"Can't complain," I said. "Thanks, man."
He smiled, his smooth, dark skin and white mustache rising in a small, sad smile. He pushed open the door and held it for me.
"Have a good night."
I nodded and stepped into the gallery. After the funeral, I came here every night religiously. Then every other night. Lately, I'd been holding steady at 3 or 4 times a week. When I had a shitty day, or when I missed Jonah too damn much, I came here. Jonah's individual glass pieces were long gone, all sold, and now living in 100 different people's houses. The long end of the L-shaped gallery was now lined with sculptures, the work of some local up-and-coming. I didn't spare them a glance. I rounded the corner to the short leg of the L. Here, Jonah's installation, a permanent fixture, rose up like a tidal wave on the far wall. The sun, always shining and vivid, beat down on waves and sea life that seemed ready to move at any moment. I took my usual seat on the bench opposite and leaned back against the wall. I crossed my arms over my chest and took in Jonah's glass. The installation was perfect, flawless, like Jonah had been in my mind's eye, the idle big brother who could do no wrong to his little brother who'd worshipped the ground he'd walked on. I squeezed my eyes shut against the perfection. I knew if Jonah were here, he'd tell me it wasn't my fault. He'd say Casey was an adult who could make her own decisions. Sometimes I believed him. Sometimes the gallery was my sanctuary, the cathedral of glass where I found peace. The same serenity Casey discovered in Jonah's glass paperweights. Sometimes. Tonight, there was no peace. I'd made my brother a promise and failed to keep it. I forced myself to open my eyes and look at Jonah's masterpiece, the brilliant colors blurred in my unblinking gaze. The blue of the sea poured down from ceiling to spill over the floor. I could smell the salt, feel the cold water against my skin, and the sting of salt water in my eyes, like tears. An ocean of never-ending tears.
Chapter 2. Casey. This song is from my album, Shattered Glass. It's called The Lighthouse. I hope you like it. The audience at Le Chacal clapped and whistled their approval. Murmured conversations ended. A few clinks of ice in a glass, and then the little jazz club went silent, waiting. Honestly, I didn't give a shit if the audience liked the song or not. It just sounded like something I should say. I believed in it more than, "This song is from my album." My album. As if it were a tangible object, a packaged CD, or even digital files. Instead of 12 songs, I scratched into a notebook and slapped against some music. I sold my songs on stage and called it an album. People paid a cover to get into the club, I got a cut. 4 different clubs, 4 nights a week. And since I packed every house of those 4 clubs, it was good money. Good enough to keep a routine. I had a routine now. I adjusted my guitar and nearly knocked over the mic stand. The floor was spinning lazily beneath the stool I sat on, and the stage lights hurt. Big fuzzy blobs of light to sear my eyes. The audience beyond was a blur of faces. I closed my eyes. I didn't need to see anyway. My fingers found the frets. My right hand strummed the strings. And a song came out. Routine. My body knew what to do, and it seemed no matter how drunk I was, it would always remember. Muscle memory, or maybe something more. Maybe when a song lives this deep in you, it becomes part of you. I hit every note and sang every word of The Lighthouse, with no more thought than I paid to breathing. Frets, strings, strum, song, breathe. 4 nights a week. Wednesday through Saturday. It's funny, we have the same exact work schedule, he said. Wednesday through Saturday nights. I requested those days, I said. They're the best shifts. Jonah smiled. They are. My chest constricted, and tears burned behind my closed eyes. After 6 months, I should have been used to the way he snuck up on me. Little bits of conversation. Little slivers of memory. Little moments. Jonah. I was crying now, but the audience loved it. They expected it. Tears were part of the act. La fille submergée, they called me. The drowned girl. I cried just hard enough to enhance the song without disrupting it. At least, that's what some chick in the bathroom at Bon Bon, my Saturday night gig, once told me. I made the tears and the sharp intakes of breath part of the experience. She had an experience listening to me sing. What a fucking abomination, I wanted to tell her. Jonah is dead, and I'm turning it into an experience. I finished the song, and applause drowned my murmured, thank you. I slipped off the stool and carefully picked my way across the stage, more than ready for my post-show cocktail.
You sounded good tonight, sweets,
Biggie said as I took my reserved seat at the corner. The bartender had a short-cropped, reddish-blonde beard and a perfectly shaved head. His real name was Mike Budney, but everyone called him Big Easy, or Big E. He reminded me of Hugo, the pony club bodyguard in Vegas. Big and intimidating on the outside, but total mush inside.
When are you going to invite one of your friends to listen to you play?
He asked.
Or family.
Every night I worked at Le Chacal. Big E tried to pry some personal information out of me. He openly worried about me, and never gave up trying to dig up some kind of hint about my past. The third degree again, I squinted up at him. The lighted shelf of liquor bottles behind him pierced my eyes. I should call you Sherlock.
You do call me Sherlock,
he said quietly.
You just never remember.
I snorted a laugh and sipped my drink. My family is busy, I said, my words tripping over themselves. And you're my friend. I gave him a watery, playful smile. You always listen to me play. What more do I need?
A lot, sweets.
Biggie replied somberly.
You need a lot. You need help.
Help. For all his prying and not-so-subtle intervention, he'd never said that word before. Since I'd moved out of Vegas and cut myself off from everyone, I hadn't heard it before either. I need help. I sniffed and downed my whiskey, pushed the glass across the bar toward him. If you want to help me, you'll give me one more.
Last one,
Biggie said, pouring a finger of whiskey into my glass.
I'm not giving up on you, Casey.
I raised my drink in a mock toast and took a sip. I clinked my teeth painfully on the edge of the glass, ruining the I've got my shit together, thank you very much vibe I was trying to exude.
Ow! Fuck!
You okay?
Asked a voice on my left. A young, good-looking guy with tatted arms and slicked-back hair had slid onto the bar stool beside me.
That sounded painful.
All teeth intact, I muttered, sipping my drink.
Good thing,
the guy said.
You have a beautiful smile.
I snorted wetly. Is that so?
I don't know, actually,
the guy replied.
The drowned girl doesn't smile, but I'd like a shot at changing that.
He flashed his own winning smile and held out his hand.
I'm Jesse.
Casey. I shook his hand, then tried to take it back, but he held it fast.
Love your ink,
he said, inspecting the creepy, thorny vines that crept up the loose sleeve of my off-the-shoulder blouse. Don't remember, I said, giving over a lie and withdrawing my hand. Big E watched us as he cleaned a glass with a white rag. Guys hit on me on a semi-regular basis. They didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of going home with me, or even taking me out on a date. But I let them try. Listening to their bad pickup lines, or even their genuine attempts to get to know me, reminded me of another time. Another girl. The one who would have laughed and flirted and jumped into bed with a guy like Jesse. The girl I'd been before Jonah. Now, the hollowed-out wreck I'd become was repulsed by the idea of being touched by a man. But sometimes they bought me drinks. And since Big E had been acting especially ridiculous about my cocktail quota lately, I sat up a little straighter and gave Jesse my version of a smile, a weak quirk on the lips. I pretended to be interested in the ink that covered his nicely muscled forearms, and within minutes, I had a fresh drink in front of me, and we were comparing tattoos. I was drunk as shit, and being very, very careless. I showed Jesse the tiny black star smattered over my middle and ring finger. This was my first. I got it in San Diego. Pacific Beach. I flipped him the bird. I chose that finger in particular. A big fuck you to my dad.
Nice.
I traced the vines up my arm. This one came from a place in San Diego, too.
So you do remember?
Jesse laughed. Honey, you buy another round. And I'll remember anything you want me to. I would have cringed to be on the receiving end of such sloppy, fake flirtation. But such is the beauty of being drunk. It's so much easier not to give a shit. The only beauty, actually. The one and only shining truth. Jesse bought another round. I got drunker and we compared ink like soldiers comparing battle scars. He lifted his dark blue t-shirt to reveal a nicely sculpted chest and abs, though he could have been covered in moles and boils for all I cared. He turned in his seat to show me the coppery Saints football helmet inked on his right shoulder blade.
"This was my first," he said, "from Jake's up on Canal Street."
His eyes drifted blearily to my bare right collarbone.
"Show me another, Casey,"
he said, in what he probably thought was a seductive voice. Hell, in another life, it would have sounded that way. And I'd have climbed onto his lap until Biggie kicked us out for inappropriate PDA. I played along and rubbed my chin on the bare skin of my shoulder. "I can't," I said. "Not without taking something off." Jesse's blue eyes glazed over.
"I can deal with that."
I said, closing my eyes against the spinning room. It wasn't cool to lead him on like this. I should stop. I have nothing to give him. "I have nothing," I muttered, the words falling off the train of thought, chugging sluggishly through my whiskey-soaked brain. "I was supposed to have one here." I nudged my bare shoulder with my chin again. "But I never picked one out. I left before I got my tattoo from Teddy." His name made me flinch, and I kept talking to drown it in a sea of meaningless words. I didn't know what I wanted, so I left it blank. I left with nothing. I have nothing. Because I left. I was supposed to stay, but I left. The tears were welling in my eyes. Drowned girl fame or not, crying in the middle of being hit on is a big turnoff. Jesse rubbed his hand over his lips, none too sober himself, and unsure how to proceed.
"Hey, it's okay. So,"
his smile was obscenely bright,
"you like football?"
Biggie leaned his bulk over the bar, looking more like a bouncer at a motorcycle club than a bartender at a jazzy dive.
"She's done, man,"
he told Jesse.
"You get me?"
Jesse nodded and slipped off the bar stool with a sour expression. He'd blown $20 plying me with top-shelf whiskey, but he didn't argue with Biggie. Not many people did. The bartender turned his gaze to me, his features softening under his rust-colored beard.
"Call you a cab, sweets."
I nodded and whispered, "Thank you." Big E got the bar back to cover him and half-carried me and my guitar through the dim confines of Le Chacal to the curb outside. Our own Thursday night routine. The New Orleans night was cool and breezy. The neon sign of Le Chacal bright against its brick facade. I tried to muster a shred of dignity as we waited for the cab, but the sidewalk kept slipping out from under my feet. One more drink, and I might black out. I wondered what would happen if I did. Would I end up in the back of Jonah's limo? "Put me there, Big," I slurred. "Where he is. It's the only place I want to be."
"Teddy?"
"No." My shaking head stilled. "Maybe. I miss him, too. I miss them all. But I left, and that's the end of the story." Big E tightened his grip on my waist as the cab pulled to the curb.
"You came here from Las Vegas, right? I think you said so once."
"So?" Ignoring my question, he told the cabbie my address and helped me into the back seat. There was something about Big E's cool expression I didn't like. Even drunk out of my mind, I could sense he was up to something. "What? Are you going to tell Rufus about this? Lose me my gig?"
"Never,"
Big E said. He leaned his bulk into the open door.
"But I told you, sweets, I'm not giving up on you."
He shut the door and banged the roof of the cab to tell the driver to head out. I slumped back in the seat, a vague sense of disquiet humming along my nerves, making me itchy. The French Quarter was a murky blur on the other side of the taxi window, giving way to the darker rows of shotgun houses in my Seventh Ward neighborhood. Vegas had been brown, beige, pale yellow, and light blue. New Orleans wore the colors of time and vibrant history, chipped paint in red and white, green everywhere, the greenish-brown river, green bayou, green air thick with humidity, green plants and bushes and weeping trees. I stumbled up the short walk to my front door. It took 3 or 4 tries to get the key into the lock because the porch was dark. Jonah's whiskey lights had long since burnt out. Inside my tiny shotgun, I dropped onto the couch, my bag and guitar hitting the ground with a twang. My head sank against the cushions, and my eyes closed. There is beauty everywhere, even in the things that scare you the most. I came awake with a gasp, sprawled on my couch. Not Jonah's. No ugly green and orange afghan on my shoulders. No glass art on the coffee table. The clock on the wall said I'd been out for 20 minutes. A sobering 20 minutes. Or maybe it was Jonah's words echoing in my ear. Beauty in the things that scare you the most. What scared me the most was letting the pain in. Or out, rather. It was already in me. It lived in me. I had to keep it down deep, drown it, so it didn't break me apart into tiny pieces. I went to the kitchen to make my nightcap. A shotgun house is aptly named. In days of old, you could aim a shotgun from the front door and shoot it straight to the back door. Every room in my small house was lined up in a row. Living room, kitchen, bedroom, and bathroom. A straight line to the back porch. A simple route, easy to stumble along. Important details in the home of a 24/7 drunk. I opened the cabinet holding more bottles than food. My nightcap was vodka over ice with a splash, a tiny splash, of water. I carried the glass to my bedroom. Like the rest of my place, the bedroom was filled with secondhand furniture. Pieces I'd picked up from yard sales when I'd first fled Vegas for New Orleans. It had a shabby chic charm the home and garden shows were always crowing about. But mine was more shabby than chic. I needed a couch to sit on, sometimes sleep on if I didn't make it to the bedroom. And so I bought a couch. In orange. I needed a chair, so I bought